question has been asked as to what are the options of the indigenous people in the face of the coming and advancing onslaught of an industrial society, a seaborne society, a global society, one part of a global circumstance. This is a complicated question, and it's at the heart of the whole discussion of globalization. I suppose one might call it even decolonization theory, if you want to get to that point. In fact, one of the things one always has to consider in studying empire is what role do quote-unquote subject people have to do with what comes their way? Are they participants in the process? Are they collaborators in the process? Do they want this to happen? And of course, that bears the question on the question of what do they want and how much do they want? Right back to the sea otter days, the ships brought tin, copper, iron, from which you could make tools, clothing, claws, buttons, needles, awls, axes, axe handles, small boats, etc., etc. Brought foodstuffs as well. The indigenous people had more sea otters to exploit than they could possibly get to until by 1830 that whole trade had died up, partly because of changing the fashions, changing trade relations, war also intervenes, and other features. But in point of fact, we find ourselves as historians looking back on this and saying, well, what was the prime cause? Well, it's human interactions, isn't it? It's the exchange of goods and commodities. Sadly, of course, there is also the exchange of pestilence and disease, and violence comes into the story as well. The smart imperial historians that I've read talk about collaboration. They talk about how native leadership tends to favor or move in such a way that it favors their people or they themselves. This is a very tricky thing, because it backs up against the whole argument that indigenous people are victims. In terms of religion, when I lived in Montana, I learned about Father de Schmet. Now, he's the famous Jesuit, and I learned that he was working his way through Montana when some emissaries came from a Coeur d'Alene tribe, I believe it was, who said, don't forget to stop here, and because we want to know what's going on. We want to be part of this process as well. Indigenous people in this particular case, maybe it's more generally the case, didn't want to be missed out. A second example, at Fort Rupert, the Kwakwaka'wakw were very upset that William Duncan was paying all attention to the Tsimshian people at Metlakatla. And please, won't you send us a priest here to help educate and tell us about the gospel, et cetera, et cetera. Well, ultimately, he sends Alfred James Hall to be the minister at Fort Rupert, and he has a very difficult time there for various reasons that I've written about. My point is, did what was the role that was taken by the host or receiving peoples in this whole process of empire? Now, this is a contrary view to the widely assumed assumption and proclaimed probably in every history department in the Western world, that empire was thrust on everybody and there was no options, no choices. But the theories of collaboration were developed by William Roger Lewis and by Robbie Robinson, and they're very well worth considering. On the other side of things, there's the decolonization theories and arguments that were put together by the new nationalists in the period after the Second World War, the Fanz Fanon of this world. He wrote about the wretched of the earth, right? And there were many others who wrote of this same sort of argument. The Europeans arrived. They brought the worst they possibly could. They robbed us of our resources. They took our resources. They left us disease. They spoiled our peoples and our populations and so forth. And this is undoubtedly true. The whole history of North America is a history of the takeover of lands, right from very beginning to well into our own times. This is a factor. We have this, we bear this as a detail of history. One could say the same thing in New Zealand. One could say the same thing in Australia, to give you two other British Commonwealth entities. South Africa is a different story in terms of population, but nonetheless, the empire expands there. Hard to turn back the clock, but when one looks at the history of North America, generally speaking, and I'll come to a conclusion about Victoria, Vancouver Island, and British Columbia at the conclusion of this, if you'll bear with me. From the very beginning, after their claim is laid down to Newfoundland in 1584, which was the first English colony in the Western Hemisphere, the Northern Western Hemisphere, right through to the French English Wars, the Dutch are involved in there at one time. We get the American Revolutionary War, we get the War of 1812, we get the Western battles of the frontier, we get the Civil War in the West. We get the trading relations established on the north, which is violence deferred. The violence comes in a different way, I suppose. We have this situation in which you north of the line, a royal establishment occurs under the British Crown. Even after having fought wars against the French and resolving the problems of Quebec, and the solution of that, which I think is one of the greatest triumphs of British imperial policy, because Quebec remains within Canada, and has been and will. It is an extraordinary story. Leaving that aside, the growth of constitutional government, brought with it the provisions of peace, order, and good government. It brought with it the Indian Act. It brought with it the division of authority, and then the authority of the Crown and the government of Canada bears its responsibility of, we call it, fiduciary responsibility for the Indigenous people. So this is the protective arm, the supposed protective arm of the government. And it relates to the same sort of things I talked about have talked about before, about what was going on in the Parliamentary Committee inquiry in 1857 about how the First Nations or the Indigenous peoples were being treated. Where were they being victimized? What was the role of liquor? What was the role of disease in their future? Did your question is did the Indigenous people have a choice? Well, they weren't possible to stand or defend against liquor or disease. No society is, right? No society is free of that. And they were particularly vulnerable on both accounts or both instances. Whether or not they encouraged tribal or inter-nation fighting is another question. Because on the Northwest Coast, the First Nations of British Columbia were very violent people. They were very strongly militant. They had martial bearing. They were raiding frequently. And we should never diminish the importance of the militant capacities of these people. If we rob them, if we take away their militant capacities and the war capabilities of raiding and slave taking and headhunting, we rob them of their own dignity. We've got to accept it that they were a militant and violent people at that time, and there's lots of descriptive evidence of that. So, in short, to try to wrap this up, one could say there's no escape, that victims are the result. Yes. Secondly, yes, that's the case. Thirdly, what benefits derive from this? Changes of food, ability to hunt, ability to provide increase of in standard of living, communities, missions, schools, education, civil rights, recognition under the law. All of these things come in consequence. I'm not saying that these are good and beneficial. I'm saying that these are the transfers that come in consequence of a progression. Well, you'll say, well, was this a British imperial design? It was not a British imperial design. The British imperial design was to protect the lands of northern North America against the United States and against Russia in Alaska. That was the purpose. And the idea of the Confederation comes along in consequence of that. These wars were, incidentally, were not of Britain's choosing. They invariably find themselves defending these territories reluctantly because of aggressors coming and going into their territories. An example of this, 1713, the French are fighting against the English in Hudson Bay. The great d'Iberville, one of the greatest figures of our history, comes in with a sailing expedition and ousts the English. Well, the English have to, in Hudson Bay, at their forts. And so the English have to respond to that and defend it. And they do. And the Treaty of Utrecht solves that and says, okay, the French are no longer welcome in Hudson Bay. This is British territory. And the French government recognizes that. So do you follow me on this? I mean, it's so much of our, so much of Canadian history has been established by default. It's not been a grand design. We talk about Johnny McDonald and the grand design of the CPR and the National national dream. That's fine. But that's latter day stuff. I mean, the underlying circumstances are that others are after it, and as it turns out, it's the British who want to trade and want to protect that trade who come to resolve it. And in many, many cases, particularly in the Great Lakes area, in the War of 1812 and the American Revolutionary War, the indigenous peoples are allies of the British Crown in this. And it's not until after the War of 1812 comes to an end that the military alliance of the two peoples, the indigenous and the non-indigenous people, comes to an end. I find Canadian history has been so badly interpreted and written because it doesn't understand this reactive nature of how the country comes into existence, not by default, certainly not by design, but certainly by a reactive capacity. That's a very long answer to a very good question.